Državni izpitni center.
Splošna matura 2014.
Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Jaswinder Sangera, a woman of Indian origin living in Britain. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
It's been 30 years since Jaswinder ran away from home at the age of 15. She fled to escape a forced marriage to a much older man from India whom she had never met. Many years later, she set up Karma Nirvana, a charity which today supports thousands of British Asian girls who are married off against their will or experience violence in the name of honour. Jaswinder is largely credited with bringing the government's Forced Marriage Act into being. She was recently cited by Prime Minister David Cameron as being influential in changing his perception about this issue. But the achievements for which she has received international recognition have made her something of an outcast from the British Sikh community, which was an important part of her parents' life when they left the Punjab in the 1950s.
My father was a farmer, a landowner over there, and he came over here in search of work. My mother told me she married when she was 14 and a half, and she was my father's second wife because the first wife was my mother's sister who died. One of my sisters, who's the eldest sister from the first wife, was left behind because they married her before they came here.
Jaswinder's mother, Jagia Kaur, married Jaswinder's father after his first wife, her older sister, died. Together they had five daughters and a son, and from the start, Jagia Kaur identified her spirited fourth daughter, Jaswinder, as the difficult one.
When my mother arrived in this country, she only spoke Punjabi, but she never, ever took it upon herself to learn the language, the English language. I personally believe my mother never learnt English because she never wanted to integrate. My mother always used to say to me that the worst insult you can ever bring to my front door is that you're behaving like a white person. Actually, she said a white woman. And somehow, not speaking the English language meant that I'm still keeping my Asian identity.
Jaswinder, we're in Northumberland Street in Derby. Why this location?
This is where my father bought his first house. The house actually has been pulled down, but opposite me are terrace houses that are identical to the ones we lived in. And my father used to work nights. He worked nights all his life. So there was me, my sisters, five sisters, one brother. And me and my sisters all shared one bedroom together. And my brother had his own bedroom at night.
So your brother basically had a bedroom that your father used during the day?
Yes. and my mother would sleep on the sofa downstairs.
Your brother had his own bedroom, all the girls were squashed into the other bedroom. Mm. But was there any other difference in the way your parents treated your brother to his sisters?
You always saw this privileged treatment that the brother had compared to us in ways such as, for example, when my mother made roti, which is chapatis, he would be served first. We would be serving him. He was the one who had the hot water for the bath. We would jump in his bath water to have a bath because he was a boy. And she was always reminded by people in our community, oh, you poor thing, you know, you've got daughters, poor you, but never mind, God has blessed you with a son. So, you know, this young boy in her life was almost the blessing.
And the saviour.
The saviour, almost, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, she treated him as God.
Now you will hear the recording again.
It's been 30 years since Jasvinda ran away from home at the age of 15. She fled to escape a forced marriage to a much older man from India whom she had never met. Many years later, she set up Karma Nirvana, a charity which today supports thousands of British Asian girls who are married off against their will or experience violence in the name of honour. Jasvinda is largely credited with bringing the government's Forced Marriage Act into being. She was recently cited by Prime Minister David Cameron as being influential in changing his perception about this issue. But the achievements for which she has received international recognition have made her something of an outcast from the British Sikh community, which was an important part of her parents' life when they left the Punjab in the 1950s.
My father was a farmer, a landowner over there, and he came over here in search of work. My mother told me she married when she was 14 and a half, and she was my father's second wife because the first wife was my mother's sister who died. One of my sisters, who's the eldest sister from the first wife, was left behind because they married her before they came here.
Jasvinda's mother, Jagia Kaur, married Jasvinda's father after his first wife, her older sister, died. Together they had five daughters and a son, and from the start, Jagia Kaur identified her spirited fourth daughter, Jasvinda, as the difficult one.
When my mother arrived in this country, she only spoke Punjabi, but she never, ever took it upon herself to learn the language, the English language. I personally believe my mother never learnt English because she never wanted to integrate. My mother always used to say to me that the worst insult you can ever bring to my front door is that you're behaving like a white person. Actually, she said a white woman. And somehow, not speaking the English language meant that I'm still keeping my Asian identity.
Jasvinda, we're in Northumberland Street in Derby. Why this location?
This is where my father bought his first house. The house actually has been pulled down, but opposite me are terraced houses that are identical to the ones we lived in. And my father used to work nights. He worked nights all his life. So there was me, my sisters, five sisters, one brother, and me and my sisters all shared one bedroom together, and my brother had his own bedroom at night.
So your brother basically had a bedroom that your father used during the day?
Yes, and my mother would sleep on the sofa downstairs.
Your brother had his own bedroom, all the girls were squashed into the other bedroom, but was there any other difference in the way your parents treated your brother to his sisters?
You always saw this privileged treatment that the brother had compared to us, in ways such as, for example, when my mother made roti, which is chapatis, he would be served first. We would be serving him. He was the one who had the hot water for the bath. We would jump in his bath water to have a bath because he was a boy. And she was always reminded by people in our community, oh, you poor thing, you know, you've got daughters, poor you, but never mind, God has blessed you with a son. So, you know, this young boy in her life was almost the blessing.
And the saviour.
The saviour, almost, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, she treated him as God.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with James Parry. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Wildlife travel writer James Parry has visited many of the world's deserts and found time to write The Desert, Wildlife on the Last Frontier. James, I suppose that they do support life after all. Is this surprising in some cases, do you think?
Yes, it is, although I think the point about deserts is they're not immediately full of wildlife. This is why we often associate them with being sort of barren wildernesses. And you do have to work hard to see the animals. I mean, I've spent days in some deserts and hardly seen anything bigger than a beetle. And the point is that this isn't big game hunting, you know, and you're not out there with your camera looking for large beasts.
Yeah.
Although, paradoxically, there are deserts where large animals do still exist, and historically there were certain deserts that were teeming with large animals. And the Sahara is a good example. And that has changed in recent years. And I think, in a way, that's what prompted me to look at deserts more closely, because they're probably the least valued of the major landscapes in the world, I would say. You know, we all know that rainforests are sexy. They're
yes.
teeming with life. You know, they're there in front of you. We all believe that, you know, the figures that banded around, you know, thousands of species, yeah. you know, per square metre almost. It's fine. Deserts less so, harder to sell them as places to see wildlife or as places to protect.
How do you define a desert? What is
well, it's all to do with rain, basically. I think most people would agree that a place that's receiving less than 250 millimetres of rain in a year is a real desert.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always preferred to define it rather more broadly than that and say that actually we really should be talking about drylands.
Right, okay.
And these are places that receive less than 500 or 600 millimetres of rain in a year, often very erratic. They might not receive any rain at all in some years, and the following year they get a decent amount. And if you look at it in those terms, about 40% of the world's land surface is drylands.
40%?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, it's a significant amount of land area.
And am I right in thinking that it's 20% of the world would be classed as deserts?
Yes, it's true.
So that's
deserts.
Still an yes. amazing amount.
It's still a hell of a lot. And a lot of those deserts are under real pressure now. And part of the research that I was doing for the book was looking at specific conservation issues. And it's rather scary what's happening. I mean, I've travelled a lot in the Gulf, for example.
Mm.
And we all know the recent history of the Gulf. Lots of oil and gas revenues, huge increases in the standard of living for local people. Some of the Gulf states are now the richest nations in the world. What's happened to the desert there? Well, it's gone from being central to the life of the people that lived there to being almost a peripheral concern. It's something that they speed through
yes.
in their air-conditioned vehicles between one gleaming city and another. And it's almost become a wasteland, a nowhere place, littered with plastic bags, and where they might sometimes go to the desert, quote, for an evening out. You know, these are people whose fathers and grandfathers lived in the desert. It was everything to them. They derived their living from it. And that started me thinking about how perceptions of deserts are changing and have changed, certainly, in that part of the world. I mean, at the same time, of course, quite a lot of this new money is being invested in conservation and restoration mm-hmm. programs. And this is good. I was recently travelling in Qatar, and they're doing some very good work there on even the small animals like hedgehogs. You know, I mean, we're not just talking about the famous gazelles and oryx of Arabia. You know, hedgehogs, they're specialist desert creatures in that part of the world. So it was good to see that people were looking into that.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Wildlife travel writer James Parry has visited many of the world's deserts and found time to write The Desert, Wildlife on the Last Frontier. James, I suppose that they do support life after all. Is this surprising in some cases, do you think?
Yes, it is, although I think the point about deserts is they're not immediately full of wildlife. This is why we often associate them with being sort of barren wildernesses. And you do have to work hard to see the animals. I mean, I've spent days in some deserts and hardly seen anything bigger than a beetle. And the point is that this isn't big game hunting, you know, and you're not out there with your camera looking for large beasts.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, paradoxically, there are deserts where large animals do still exist, and historically there were certain deserts that were teeming with large animals. And the Sahara is a good example. And that has changed in recent years. And I think, in a way, that's what prompted me to look at deserts more closely, because they're probably the least valued of the major landscapes in the world, I would say. You know, we all know that rainforests are sexy. They're
yes.
teeming with life. You know, they're there in front of you. We all believe that, you know, the figures that banded around, you know, thousands of species, yeah. you know, per square metre almost. It's fine. Deserts less so, harder to sell them as places to see wildlife or as places to protect.
How do you define a desert? What is
well, it's all to do with rain, basically. I think most people would agree that a place that's receiving less than 250 millimetres of rain in a year is a real desert.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always preferred to define it rather more broadly than that and say that actually we really should be talking about drylands.
Right, okay.
And these are places that receive less than 500 or 600 millimetres of rain in a year, often very erratic. They might not receive any rain at all in some years, and the following year they get a decent amount. And if you look at it in those terms, about 40% of the world's land surface is drylands.
40%?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, it's a significant amount of land area.
And am I right in thinking that it's 20% of the world would be classed as deserts?
Yes, it's true.
So that's
deserts.
Still an yes. amazing amount.
It's still a hell of a lot. And a lot of those deserts are under real pressure now. And part of the research that I was doing for the book was looking at specific conservation issues. And it's rather scary what's happening. I mean, I've travelled a lot in the Gulf, for example.
Mm.
And we all know the recent history of the Gulf. Lots of oil and gas revenues, huge increases in the standard of living for local people. Some of the Gulf states are now the richest nations in the world. What's happened to the desert there? Well, it's gone from being central to the life of the people that lived there to being almost a peripheral concern. It's something that they speed through
yes.
in their air-conditioned vehicles between one gleaming city and another. And it's almost become a wasteland, a nowhere place, littered with plastic bags, and where they might sometimes go to the desert, quote, for an evening out. You know, these are people whose fathers and grandfathers lived in the desert. It was everything to them. They derived their living from it. And that started me thinking about how perceptions of deserts are changing and have changed, certainly, in that part of the world. I mean, at the same time, of course, quite a lot of this new money is being invested in conservation and restoration mm-hmm. programs. And this is good. I was recently travelling in Qatar, and they're doing some very good work there on even the small animals like hedgehogs. You know, I mean, we're not just talking about the famous gazelles and oryx of Arabia. You know, hedgehogs, they're specialist desert creatures in that part of the world. So it was good to see that people were looking into that.
This is the end of section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize.
Nasvidenje in srečno.